Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey everybody, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Penn Holderness. Thank you so much for joining us on our favorite thing that we do all week, the Holderness Family Podcast.
I love the chance to just sit down and have a conversation. Why don't we do this more often?
We have to do other things.
Yes.
You know what we could do? We could just give up something. We could give up our kids, or we could give up our Facebook videos, or we could give up, want to give up? Eating? Sleeping?
No.
We could give up sleeping.
No. Anyway, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to enjoy this time while we have it. Thank you so much for listening, downloading, subscribing, and leaving reviews. When you leave a review, it helps other people find us. So here's a recent review from PNW, Pacific Northwest, Chrissy.
Chrissy. No, I just was thinking of Stranger Things.
Oh.
That's not a good Chrissy. Sorry, this is a different Chrissy.
Yeah, okay, different Chrissy.
Gotcha.
Although... No,
Indiana.
Yeah. I hope that I never meet Penn and Kim in person.
Oh.
Because of this podcast, in my head, we are best friends.
Oh.
And if I did meet them in person, I would talk and act like we were best friends, and that would be so awkward.
No.
I think you should still... I would love to meet you, Chrissy.
By the way, Chrissy, that does sometimes happen. People just come up and talk to us like they know us, and it's great.
It's great.
It's because it's not small talk.
So,
and you know who hates small talk?
I cannot... do small talk.
Right.
So it's actually better if we can just fast forward, pause, like, bloop, bloop, bloop. The difference is I do want to know about you. So it is like, you'll have to answer some questions of like,
what's your deal?
What's your deal?
Chrissy, what's your deal?
What's your deal, Chrissy? I have to say, so I have to get a wrist surgery.
Oh, let's talk about
that. Okay. But it was awkward because we went through the whole, this was a better interaction. So it went through this whole appointment. And then the doctor said, hey, actually, there's this video you did. It's really funny. I really appreciate it. And it was like on the way out.
Okay.
Whereas I have had the opportunity to have a pelvic exam at the, you know, my yearly OBGYN appointment. And the nurse, as she's literally lifting
the old
curtain,
yep,
say, hey, I saw that video you did. And then it's like, scoot down, please. So I've had that experience too. So like, yeah, that's been.
That must be like when I was in college and I had the hernia. And in order to check for a hernia, I got a hernia for singing too loud in a band. And to check for a hernia, you had to put, the doctor has to put their finger up your butt. And then I saw that doctor the next night at a bowling alley.
Is where he's practicing.
No, that was part of it, because that's really like I looked at him and then I put my fingers in the bowling balls and I was like, I don't know how to handle this. We have gone off the rails again.
This conversation about awkward medical encounters has nothing to do with a conversation we are about to have.
No, but in this, listen. All right. We love talking to Dr. Emily King. She's been on this show before. She is generally the most cheerful, like positive solution based person. And there are bits and elements of that, but we're talking about some serious problems when it comes to education, teachers in particular, as a result of what's happened to our world over the last couple of years. And I could tell by talking to her, we've already had the interview, that number one, she's very passionate about this. And number two, she believes that this is a real problem.
Okay. So just to clarify what my husband just said, we're starting a new school year and there is a teacher shortage. And not only is there a teacher shortage, we are expecting a lot from our teachers. So today we're going to be talking about how you as a concerned, you know, neighbor, friend, parent can help support your kids and the type of partner you can be with your teachers, especially in a neurodivergent setting. Mm-hmm. So we're talking ADHD, autism, different ways to learn, because they're all just different ways to learn, how to be more supportive as teachers. And we all take on this daunting task of sending our kids back to school.
And she has a lot of great suggestions on how to do that right now. I also thought it was interesting at the very end. I was just curious because she's been studying schools and the psychology of them. I asked her what she could do if she could just start a school from scratch. And her answer was something I hadn't thought of.
Okay, Dr. Emily King is a child psychologist who has worked with neurodivergent children and teens for the last 20 years. She received her PhD in school psychology from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where she worked at the Carolina Institute for Developmental Disabilities and the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute. She spent 5 years consulting with teachers as a school psychologist in public elementary, middle, and high schools before starting her private practice. Dr. Emily is also the founder of LearnWithDrEmily.com, where she shares online resources related to raising and educating neurodivergent youth. She has been featured on MSNBC's Morning Joe and has been quoted in the New York Times, Washington Post, and has written for Parents.com. Dr. Emily is passionate about empowering parents and teachers to take care of themselves so they can grow into the adult that every neurodivergent child needs in their life. She and her husband are parents of 2 boys, 9 and 14, who are her greatest teachers. And I do have to read their disclaimer. Information provided by Dr. King is intended for informational purposes only, not intended to diagnose or treat any mental health condition or to provide psychological services directly to clients. Listeners are encouraged to seek advice of a qualified mental health professional with any questions or concerns. Welcome to the show once again, Dr. Emily King.
Thank you for having me.
We are so excited. Last time we spoke, I believe you had just broken
both feet
of your feet
upon falling down, I think, some stairs. And
hate to laugh, but it was like COVID. Well, break 1 foot, break 2 feet.
It's been actually 2 years.
Right. Yes.
Almost to the day. It was in August of that year. And nothing like slipping on a step and taking out both of your feet to make you really appreciate telehealth with your clients, because you can't go anywhere anyway.
I mean, that was part of it, right? Because you were stuck at home and then you broke both
already
of your feet. So we're starting out with that because we love Dr. King. She has a good sense of self. She has an even better sense of what's going on in the world, particularly as we talked about in the intro, our schools, our teachers, and our students.
Yeah, and I think that I'm very aware as I'm sending my kids back to school, I've heard a lot that there's most definitely a social deficit our kids have had. I mean, they were out of school because of COVID or homeschooled or learning from home. And then, so there's that. Mm-hmm. But then I just feel like the modern classroom right now, I just don't know. And it's nobody's fault. It's not the teacher's fault right now. I'm not going to heap anything more on the teachers. But I just don't know how it's serving teachers. And I definitely don't think it's serving most students, or at least students that don't fit into those perfect like boxes. And by the way, our kids don't fit into those perfect boxes of the kids that learn in that very traditional
way. It seems
way.
Like fewer and fewer do.
Yeah. So that's why we wanted you here today. As we're heading in and sending our kids off to another school year, what are ways we can help our kids and what are ways we can help our teachers?
Well, I'll start by saying from like a bird's eye view of this, this is not new. It's just harder than ever before because we are asking teachers to do more with the same or less than before. We're asking our kids to do really the same or more because they're a grade older with not as much practice, social practice, academic practice. It's just highlighting all the things about education that aren't flexible And I think that's, you know, the takeaway from any time I talk about this is we need more flex for our kids, for our teachers, for ourselves. The education system is standardized in a very inflexible way. There are reasons to that. There are reasons that we need to make sure everybody gets exposed to curriculum, make sure that everybody has accountability to track how kids are learning. But when we do it so rigidly with not enough flexibility, we undermine, you know, teachers' awareness of what this one child on the ground needs in this moment to connect and learn something in a little bit of a different way. And so after these 2 years, everyone is tired. Mm-hmm. So that's going to highlight our inability to push through what's hard. We're really just, I think we've all had this like existential crisis of like, what am I doing with my life? Yes. And a lot of teachers feel that way. A lot of parents feel that way. There've been so many career changes. I think some kids feel that way, yeah, of like, this friend is maybe not my friend that we were friends 2 years ago, but now we're 2 years older and we can have different interests and I could just be a different kid and be good at different things. Mm-hmm. And they're different now, so we're not a fit anymore. So helping our kids understand what's changed over the last 2 years, how they've changed, that it's totally normal for them to be, you know, a different kid going back into this maybe same school, but for many of them, a different level of schooling. I mean, it's been 2 whole years. So mm-hmm. we have so many high schoolers that may feel like they've got the organizational skills of a sixth grader. And that is kind of expected at mm-hmm. this time. So there's a lot of extra support and patience that needs to happen. I don't like the words catch up. There's a lot of catch up to do. There's a lot mm-hmm. we've got to do to get back on track. Everyone is just off the track.
Yeah, we're getting a new
and
track.
So we just right. need to slow the track down and reevaluate what's important. And there are massive systemic barriers to this. I get that. I know that. But on the ground in our relationships with our kids and our teachers and our administrators and our therapists and all the people helping us, our neighbors, you know, how can we come together and recognize this is what this kid needs, this is what this school needs, this teacher needs, and make some progress, at least in our own communities, as we're thinking about what we can do right in front of us, because there's a lot to be frustrated about if we only focus on the big picture, because we just don't have a lot of power other than voting and lobbying for education funding and things like that. You do have a little power. Mm-hmm. But just that short-term impact, yeah, that's what I've grown more and more passionate about over these last 2 years, because this whole situation has just really highlighted what's so hard about school for so many kids.
You talked about catching up. I mean, we've even used the term arrested development. I love the TV show. That's one of the reasons why. But they're like just little things that kids and even parents have just like that normal development has stopped. Penn Charles calls it the blip, which I love. He's a Marvel fan. Those of you who aren't Marvel fans, Thanos like wipes out half the population and then they come back 3 years later. So it was kind of like what COVID was. It was sort of similar, like you're gone and then you're back. Mm-hmm. But I mean, so that presents its own set of challenges. You talked about resources versus need. You talked about needing to be more flexible. True or false? We've also discovered more of our students with neurodiversity in the last few years because of COVID, because it's become more normalized, and because it's been recognized as more of a spectrum situation when it comes to neurodiversity.
True. Absolutely true.
And we'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
The two things in there to think about is there's been this almost this like perfect storm, and it's a good storm. It's like this stuff is brewed up at the same time of there's this beautiful push of diversity and around all areas of sexuality and gender and race and religion and ethnicity, but neurodiversity is in the mix too now. And it's just so normalized for our kids. Our generation of parents and educators and adults, we are the ones that are like, oh, like it's always kind of been this way. We just didn't call it this, or we had
a few categories,
yeah. But we named it something different, or we dismissed it. Or I can't tell you how many parents I work with that recognize that they have ADHD after their child is diagnosed. They're like, oh, so this is why school is so hard for me, you know? So there are things that are coming to light in this generation of our kids and our young adults. And at the same time, with COVID happening and online schooling happening, It became very clear what parts of school were really rooted in face-to-face connection with a teacher, because we pulled that variable out. Really rooted in executive functioning skills like organization and knowing when to log into the call versus being really interested and being able to talk about a topic forever. Well, that's a different skill than being able to remember to log into the call. And a very intelligent person could have both those skills in one brain, you know? So executive functioning is not indicative of intelligence, which is, you know, we've got all these variables just got really teased out during the online learning. And some families were able to pivot to like, you know, pods or small group learning. Some families pulled their kids and put them in different situations. You know, some families didn't have a choice and they had to do the thing and with online learning, but they saw their kids struggle in a way that was so different from the classroom. The flip also happened. I saw some kids with social anxiety who loved it. They're like, online school is for me. And they were so glad they didn't go into the building. So that just speaks to all of the differences we have in our sensory integration to sitting in a classroom, the crowds, the noise, the length of the school day, all the things that we need to be a student, and how being in the building is part of the experience. It's just all been really interesting to watch unfold. And now to be at a spot where we're like, okay, what do we do with this information?
Yeah, because I think the blessing of COVID has been this really wonderful opportunity to take that step back saying, is this worth doing? I mean, we've all had those kind of existential crises. So it makes sense that our kids would too. I mean, they're not aliens, they're human beings.
Right.
But also the teachers, we are facing a massive teacher shortage. And no, duh. I mean, they're not paid right. enough. They, I mean, are being asked to put their lives on the line in some situations.
Right.
So I get why teachers are running for the hills. We love teachers here. So it feels a little unfair to ask teachers to have to do more. So without the support, because what I know about teachers is like they do want to serve these kids. They do want to help these kids. So how as a parent can I support a teacher with my neurodiverse child that may have some, you know, special needs in the classroom? What is the best way to support my kid and the teacher?
Yeah. So the first thing to know is that any teacher who is back in the classroom this fall, they really want to be there.
Yeah.
Like they've thought about it.
Yeah. They all thought about it.
They've thought about it. they, you know, something is working out for them, whether they love their school community, they love these kids, they are in a situation in their family where they're able to have a job with these hours and this pay, you know, or there's something about the situation that is working for them because they said yes to it this year. Mm-hmm. So let's just start there. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing to know is that as a parent, especially after the last 2 years and this summer, you know your kid the best, you do, but you don't know them in a classroom. And I think that this is where we go wrong, kind of dismissing a teacher's expertise and sometimes dismissing a parent's expertise. So we have to come at this together of like, okay, the parent knows the child best at the home setting. The teacher knows the classroom best. So we've got to communicate. And as a parent, say, hey, this is what works for my kid when we're doing homework or when we're doing chores or when we're doing this or that. Here's what happens when I don't support. Like, let's say, you know, my kid loses all of his belongings. That one's probably going to be like across home and school settings. Mm-hmm. So you can be like, this is an established thing. We know it's happening. He knows it's hard for him. And this is how we support it. And you can give the teacher specific strategies for your kid to not have to figure it out. And that's still not stepping on the teacher's toes in terms of like, you're not telling the teacher how to do their job, but you're able to say, hey, we figured out what works with this specific skill weakness. And the teacher is going to be so grateful for that because they're not going to have to figure that out. You mm-hmm. just gave them, you know, front loaded that for them. Now, where we do step on their toes is when we say things like, my student's not going to learn about that. We're going to do like curriculum things or, you know, things that are just very rooted in, you know, too much telling a teacher how to do their job. You know, I always say go to administration with those questions if you have concerns about curriculum, because the principal, the assistant principal is going to be able to help you answer those questions and understand where those decisions have been made from a district level, a school level. The teacher is truly teaching what they've been asked to teach. And then on the ground for this kid, we are collaborators with that teacher. The best thing we can do from the beginning is to thank them, appreciate them, and go in there as a partner and helping them get to know your kid and then letting them do their thing. And I know parents are anxious. I've been there. You know, I know it feels anxiety provoking to let your kid go into the school for so many reasons right now, and especially American schools. But we have to trust so that teachers feel supported. Because when they feel like we're micromanaging or always asking or we're presenting as kind of that helicopter, I need to know everything, it's exhausting for them. And that is one more emotional load for them to do.
So this is great. Emily always comes to us with like actionable ideas, hacks, if you will. And I thought, and I mean hacks in a good way, like, you know, showing gratitude to your teacher, making sure and communicating with them when there's a delay or a shortage or whatever. I know that in the back of your mind, rather than putting like these hacks or like kind of band-aids on the issue, you'd probably like to perform a massive surgery on the educational system. And maybe we'll get to that later, but I do want to talk some more about hacks. Because I'm going back to like remembering how I got through school with ADHD. Mm-hmm. And there were some certain things that I did. And I remember when I stopped doing them, it really, really affected me adversely and affected my grades and my ability to learn. The biggest one for me was, and I wonder if we should just, this is probably terrible. I sat in the front of the class, mm-hmm. every single class. And people thought that I was a teacher's pet. But if I sat one row back, I paid about 10% less attention. If I sat another row back, it was another 10%. If I sat in the back, I was spacing out. When I got to college and there were those auditoriums where I could sit in the very far back, I could not get through 5 minutes without my mind wandering. So I'm sitting here thinking about, well, can we just make all the ADHD kids sit in the front of the class? Or is that just like sticking, like, is that really pointing them out? Is that a terrible idea? Kim?
It's not a terrible idea, but there could be plenty of ADHD kids that doesn't work for.
I know, that's true.
So it's like a menu. It's like a menu of things that could work. It's like a menu of strategies that worked for you. And that's why as parents, we need to go in and say what works for our kid. And then as they get older, like after like third, fourth grade, we need to go ahead and start encouraging them to go to meet the teacher and being like, I need to sit in the front of the class. This works for me.
Yeah.
So we're working on self-advocacy. So remember, everything you're doing for your child in preschool and early elementary school, you want it to be something that you want them to then say and advocate for mm-hmm. when they are older. So, you know, to answer your question, like that is one strategy of lots that might work, might not work. But what we want to lead with is just asking a teacher or a teacher asking a parent, what happens when Penn sits at the back of the class? Like, get curious, like what happens? And I tell like your parent, you would have a gut reaction to that. Like you just did, like, oh, I can't do that. I won't learn anything. You know, so just asking these questions of each other is really important, especially as teachers are getting to know kids and kids are getting to know teachers.
It's not what you say, it's how you say it, right, Kim?
Yes. Now, so you do have a course for teachers. This is for teachers, right? It's called the Neurodiverse Classroom. Can you tell us a little
bit about that?
Coming this fall. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that.
Yeah. So over the last 20 years, I was first a school psychologist. And then once I left the schools, I've been in private practice working mostly with neurodivergent kids with ADHD, autism, anxiety, learning needs, kind of the more complex, the better of, I love this stuff, and helping them figure out how to learn and how to live in a world that just really wasn't built for them. And then along the way, you know, I've always felt like I can only bring a child so far in therapy. There's also school and there's a parent relationship and a teacher relationship. So I've worked with, you know, parents a lot in my practice and also helping them process shifting their mindset once a child is diagnosed and really parenting the child they have and not any idea of parenting that they had. But then that's evolved, especially over the last 2 years of watching what has happened with all this information, all these variables that have been teased out in learning. And teachers don't get this training in school. They might get one class on behavior management and they might. And then if they have a master's in like special education, they're going to have more understanding of different learning needs. But most of our kids, especially our intelligent kids with ADHD, let's say, that can absolutely hang in a regular big class, they just need accommodations. They're probably going to be with a regular education teacher who doesn't have any specialized training about ADHD, mm-hmm. but is learning from colleagues or is figuring it out and trying to manage the behavior of the class, which is a reaction, which is a band-aid. How we help all of this is to help teachers better understand the brain sitting in front of them. And I had one teacher that says the soul's staring at me. And I was like, I will never forget that phrase because that's what it felt like to her, that like she was responsible for all these different learning journeys and they were all a little bit different. Yeah, the curriculum generally is the same and you're bringing them along on reading, writing, and math in elementary school, which is what I'm starting with in my course with teachers is just elementary. Let's start there because I really feel like it's for kids need to learn to be students. If we don't get it right at elementary, we lose them along the learning journey. They start to hate school mm-hmm. and that's what we want to prevent from happening. We want them to learn how to be students, learn to be seen, learn that it's okay if I need to stand and do my work, if I need to take a break because it's too loud, if I need a plan because I'm really anxious about what's coming next. Those are all little tweaks we can do that teachers just need coaching on. So I'm really excited to share all that with teachers this fall because they are hungry for information. They're put in situations where they don't have enough of this type of social emotional learning training. Schools do a really, you know, good job giving them lots of literacy training and academic. Lots of the funding is driven by academic mm-hmm. training for teachers because that is what everyone thinks is going to raise the scores. Mm-hmm. But if a child is first not regulated, feeling safe in a classroom and connected to a teacher, it doesn't matter what is being taught. It is not going to be absorbed.
Okay. You just smiled when you said that, when you said scores, because boy, does that carry with it a lot. Don't those grades have a crushing amount of relevance the older that you get in education?
Well, relevance is in air quotes because
importance, I guess, if for whatever you're going to do next.
That's why I smiled, yeah. Because this all evolved out of needing to track student progress. You know, I remember 25 years ago in graduate school taking courses on the importance of measuring student outcomes. It's how the money flows, like mm-hmm. who needs what money and, you know, what programs are working and all of this. There's this shift. Part of it is like this huge need for social emotional learning, mental health needs coming out of COVID. I hope this is the beginning of the pendulum swinging of like, hey, no one's going to actually be learning all this stuff that we're tracking unless they feel safe and connected at school. And unless this teacher feels safe and connected at school and feels supported and appreciated. And it's like, you know, happy teacher, happy classroom, yeah. Right? So it's like a home. It's like any system of an adult nurturing a child. The adult can only nurture as much as they're nurtured from the top. And that's what is missing. That's what's happening with teachers are so overwhelmed and stressed and not feeling like they're seen in these situations where we have to keep teaching all this stuff because of the scores and the outcome and all of that. And we could, you know, talk on, and it's different in every county and every state about the implications of what happens if a teacher's scores are low versus high. And there's lots of different legislation around this that a lot of people feel like is unfair to teachers, because a lot of times the scores don't actually, this is the kicker. The scores don't actually measure what neurodivergent kids know, because they're measuring test taking skills, not 100%, but a big chunk of it is how well you take a test, how well you're attending to that test, how well you're showing what you know on a bubble sheet. That's not completely related to learning. And that's the part of standardized testing that frustrates teachers and parents of mm-hmm. all neurodivergent kids. Well, 'cause we know that.
Yeah. I mean, we had a situation with one of our kids. It was very early in, I will try not to identify gender here, in their educational journey. And this sweet, sweet first year teacher had four like neurodiverse kids in the classroom, this and no assistant, because the assistant had broken her leg on the first day of school and then they never replaced the assistant. So mm-hmm. this sweet teacher dealing with four kids who were basically treated like a behavior problem because there was no other way to juggle it all. And so our child that was in this classroom, literally they, you know, parents were like waving the flag towards the end of the school year. Like our kid has not learned the things they were supposed to learn because of a classroom management style. Mm-hmm. And it was really, I was like, oh, I didn't realize. And so we had to do a little bit of remediation and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. So there's like, I think that's when I think back, because this sweet teacher was doing the best she could.
Right.
But if she can't get the support from the administration, there's no budget to get somebody else in there. That's why I think it's great. These teachers and these schools need to kind of reevaluate what the goalpost is almost, mm-hmm. but at the same time, like keeping more on teachers seems impossible. So
not sustainable.
It's not sustainable.
Educators have known this for a long time. A lot of, you know, in my world, when I talk with teachers and when I talk with parents of kids with individualized education plans, this was all hard before COVID. You know, this was all, I remember having meetings before COVID with some local legislatures, letting them know, like, this is not sustainable, like what we're doing right now. And then COVID happened. I'm like, okay, this is really not going to work.
Yeah.
Because it's just overwhelming to do a job that you don't have enough resources for. You know, that sweet teacher, of course there were behaviors in the classroom. Behaviors happen when the expectations are higher than the skills.
Right.
And that's, it's a formula.
I do hope this has nothing to do with, you know, elementary schoolers. But I do hope that they continue to make the SAT and ACT optional for college admissions, because mm-hmm. I have never, I was a terrible test taker. I knew everything, mm-hmm. terrible test taker. And it caused such stress. And it was not a good indicator of the type of student I was. Mm-hmm. Whereas he got an amazing score that he probably finished it in 45 minutes and got an amazing score. One of us worked a little harder in college and had a better GPA. And I'll let you guess who that is. I don't understand
why that had anything to do with the first part of the story, but okay.
No, but like, I just don't think those standardized tests are a good indicator for what kind of learner and student one person is.
And I agree with you there as well. That like those tests, actually, I got to tell you, for my particular brand of like ADHD, those tests checked off the three things that actually work for me: something challenging, something new, and something of personal interest, like getting into college, right? So if you have like the ability to hyper-focus on those three things, you can actually do pretty well. And then I got to college and none of those things were happening.
Right. What I just described before is the opposite of what you experienced. So we've got kids who are not good test takers, who the teacher knows they know it. They know they're learning, but the test doesn't show it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip of that are our intelligent ADHDers who are excellent test takers, check all the boxes. But those, like, congratulations for getting through college, Penn, because that's a formula for our really bright kids that drop out. Because they don't have the executive functioning management skills.
So my 2.7 GPA.
I put on academic probation.
Can I just also say I had an awesome time?
So he
I had
says,
a really good so, time.
I was
a hullabaloo. That's right.
He was in an a cappella group, but they wore bathrobes.
Excuse me. Yeah.
I would also say it has less to do with Penn. And his poor, it wasn't that he was like partying all the time. That's what he likes to say. I think it was glaring executive function delays.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Because he, for the first time, a college, and UVA is an amazing school. They asked him, they asked him to, you know, create systems and organization. Like, he had to manage all of these ideas himself, where it wasn't like, yeah, they hand you a syllabus, but it wasn't as detailed as the expectations were in high school, where it's like very clear, this is your to-do list. Like, he had to come up with his own to-do list and he didn't know how to do that.
And mother always made my to-do lists when I was, mother got me my Eagle Scout.
It's so creepy when you say mother like that.
Well, I just feel like if you're entitled and your mother did everything for you, you should say mother.
Yeah.
Mother.
So, yeah. Anyway, I think it points out that like at some point, a really smart ADHDer he gamed the system quite honestly through middle school and high school. And then it was glaring that it didn't work in college. So at some point it's going to catch you.
Well, and I'll share a personal anecdote that's for different reasons, but I also in some ways feel like I gamed the system and came into my own more in graduate school. Like, it took me that long, but I loved school. I loved school so much that I got a PhD in the psychology of school. Yeah. I mean, I just loved it. And I think I loved how organized it was and how like checkboxy it was. And
yes,
I just,
I love it.
You go in and like someone tells you what to do and it felt really safe and really predictable. And I just got really good at the system of it.
Yes.
There were classes that were not my thing. There were times where I thought I was going to do this and I decided to do something else. But once I was in college at some point, late college, and it was really taking psychology courses that started to shift me in this. The whole idea of critical thinking, which looking back on this, is kind of shocks me. I really didn't get into that whole critical thinking mindset until college, which is scary in retrospect. Because I think I was just checking someone else's boxes and I did all the things and got the diploma and went to the college and did the things. And then somewhere along the line in psychology class, someone asked me, well, what do you think is going to happen? Like, what's your hypothesis? And I'm like, ooh,
what?
I
get to have
no one's ever asked me that before.
There's no box
so
for this.
In that way, yeah. I started like having my own path of what education meant to me. And it became really obvious that I had jumped through all the hoops of standard education successfully, but it kind of missed the whole, like, what am I wanting to do?
Yeah. I identify with that so much because I think I could have been like an ADHD, but like on the inattentive side, mm-hmm. Because school was always, I had to read thing. I had to say it out loud. I had to hear it spoken to me. I had to like learn it, dance it, touch it, smell it. Like I had to learn anything to get it to stick. It took a really long time, but I could check a box. You tell me mm-hmm. what to do. I'm going to do it. I still love that. Like I love mm-hmm. a system. Mm-hmm. And so if my family had enough money, I definitely would have done graduate school, but college was the first time. Yeah, I remember my freshman year, like thinking, like, oh, they're not telling me how to think about this. Like, and up until that point, they told me how to think about it. But it was the first time I read it. Like, I had a history class, and I was like, oh, wait, it's not just what happened in the textbook. There was more that happened. What? And so that's why. I don't think college is for everybody at all.
Right.
I don't think it's for everybody. But mm-hmm. for the lack of a good plan, I think at least a little bit of college is great for that reason, because I think it's the first time, I'm going to get off my soapbox here first, that there is some flexibility and you're not under these rigid high school standards or, you know, like mm-hmm. all these like standardized tests you have to, like it's so measured that once you get to college, there is that flex, you can almost like exhale and think about like, what do I really want to learn about? What can I get curious about it? And you can ask those questions and there's time for it that I wish we had earlier.
I hope that that's where we're going. I hope that we're listening to the teachers who I know are kind of shouting these same things about, I know this kid, you know, could, you know, debate and critical think and all this middle school and high school, like earlier. Mm-hmm. And there are definitely some really great programs already out there that are doing this, and families will find these programs, or like magnet schools are a good example of this, where there are lots of electives for kids to take that are adjacent to the standard curriculum, but it's different everywhere. And you've got to know your kid and know your community and know your options. But generally speaking, we still have that system of getting kids through school because we want to give everybody that opportunity. But at some point, everyone's not getting the opportunity. Like what are we teaching them?
Yeah.
Okay. I want to ask my last question going back up to 30,000 feet.
Yeah.
You operate very well at 30,000 feet. You've just found an exact replica of Earth in some other galaxy, and the same people are there, but they don't have a school system. And you were able to design your own school system for how to educate people. What's the one big difference that you would make, one big change you would make over the way that schools are being run right now? If you could start from scratch.
I would flip the model of academics before putting the kids in the classroom and getting to know them.
The social side.
So that social emotional learning is first. Kids complete, they play all the way up till second grade. They're playing the whole time. They're getting to know each other. They're learning all their social skills, emotional, all play until 6 or 7 years old, until they're ready to then. And then teachers get to decide when they're ready to be students, when they're asked, when they're ready to like be asked to sit and listen. And then they start doing academics versus let's have 4 and 5 year olds do worksheets and assume we're not going to have any behavior problems.
Yeah. God, remember, our PC was in preschool. By the way, my son taught himself to read, and I only discovered it because I was trying to skip over sentences to get the bedtime story over with faster. And he's like, Mommy, you missed a part. I was like, oh, snap. But and I remember we got a call from preschool. They were like, you need to come get him. He's just like crazy. He like won't sit down. He's wired. I'm like, he's 4.
And you're making him do a worksheet.
Yeah, he's 4. So of course he's running around like a crazy person.
Well, hang on. That was a really simple solution. And you had that locked and loaded. Does that exist somewhere? Could we start the Emily King School for Kids Who Don't Read Good?
That's a Zoolander quote, by the way.
Well, I hope people get that. Yeah. How can they even learn to read if they can't fit inside the
school
building?
School of ants.
You get it, though. Like, could we make this happen?
Well, I think that, you know, whenever you hear educators, psychologists, any child development people talk about, you know, play-based preschools, I'm like, what other kind of preschools should they be? You know, so anytime I hear play-based preschools, I'm like, aren't they already play-based? So you're, all preschool should be play-based. You know, kindergarten should be play-based. There are things when you learn about where your child's going to go to school, there are schools out there that are very play-oriented until a certain grade. And you just need to pay attention as a parent to know your kid, just like going back to like, it worked for you to sit in the front row. That may not work for another kid. And so knowing your kid, generally speaking, though, all kids develop and all of our brains are wired to play until we, you know, settle into being able to sit in a seat and learn, you know, around ages 6 to 8. A lot of 5-year-olds are still very active. They, you know, there are many who can sit, but not all. And I just truly believe it's going to have to come from the parents and the teachers saying, this is what we want out of for our kids, out of our school system. This is what we want to happen, because it's like everything else. It's almost like a lobbying job. Like, this is what we want. And there's pressure from the top to make academics first. That's where all the money is coming from. But I feel like we're reaching a breaking point where there's some successful play-based elementary situations out there. You know, conscious discipline is another large curriculum that is, you know, huge in coaching teachers how to connect with kids first and how to regulate emotions before any of the learning can happen. These curriculums are out there. Teachers are getting trained. You know, learning about the neurodiversity of learning styles is starting to emerge, and teachers are like, oh, so I'm teaching it this way, but that's just not how their brain is wired to learn it. Mm-hmm. And so I just truly believe it's going to come from the bottom up, like most everything else that happens. And we just have to pay attention to what our kid needs, what our community needs, what our teachers need to be capable of doing this job for the long term, and to attract new teachers. You know, there's so many people who retired because it was kind of a good time to retire. Mm-hmm. If you were, you know, 62 over COVID, right? So I think we've got to do something. An administrator colleague of mine posted on social media a few weeks ago, it's time for something radical. Like, it's time mm-hmm. for some radical ideas. Because we have we have kids without teachers in the classroom right now. Gosh, yeah. It's going to be really interesting to see how different school systems problem solve this. I think there are going to be a lot of parent volunteers. I had a moment where I was like, do I quit my job and become a substitute teacher? I'm like, okay, probably not. But
you thought about it?
I'm really feeling the pull of, you know, skills I had that I wanted to share. It tugs at my heartstrings because I know there are kids that are going to be stressed because there aren't enough staff, and there's going to be staff that are stressed because there's not enough of them.
Can I ask you something, Kim?
Yes.
Everything she just said made so much sense. Mm-hmm. Everything she said felt, I was inspired by hearing this new model. I heard her saying, let's do something new and radical. I'm like, yes, yes. And there's this like tiger mom voice in the back of my head.
But my kid's not going to be, they can't read.
They're going to fall behind. They're going to fall behind. They have to be in soccer by the time they're one if they want to be on a freaking travel team. And like, so that's what you're fighting against, I would imagine, right?
So that's a you problem.
Oh, I fully understand
right?
that.
So in the most compassionate way, I am telling adults, if you are nervous about slowing down and playing and being connected with your child, if you are nervous about your teacher, you know, connecting with their class and taking time to help them learn about how they feel emotions in their body before they are faced with frustrations of learning, that's something that we in our generation of adults mm-hmm. who were not schooled like that, who I think are, there's this, I feel like it's revolutionary. Like, we are all thinking about like, oh yeah, that didn't work for me. I get it. So how can we help ourselves, our teachers in this generation of adults say, I get this. We can help our kids love learning and at the same time help our teachers love teaching. Like, who doesn't want to do that? And it just takes a radical shift in the way we think about it.
I agree. And I'm open. We need something radical. I'm the first person to co-sign on that, is we need something radical. And it is going to take, I think it was beat into our heads this very, it's just like work. If something's not working, just work harder at it. What was programmed, I think, in our generation. So like, yes. If it's not working, just do it more. And then, but we've learned that doesn't work with school. Just more of the same's not working.
Right.
So, yeah. And then also this hustle mentality of like achieve. It was, the fact that that school year went by with one of our kids, and then it wasn't until towards the end when the parents kind of got together and said, they are not meeting benchmarks, and it's because of this reason we need to figure out how to support this teacher more so our kids can. And that really made me so nervous, because I was like, oh, if my kid's not meeting this specific standard, what does that say about my kid? What does that say about me as a parent? And when really it was nothing. It took 2 seconds.
It doesn't say anything about you as a parent.
No.
It says there's something going on in that classroom that wasn't an optimal environment for learning. All of that can be pivoted and, figured out moving forward in a different way. And I'm not saying like kumbaya, let's all just sit around and sing songs and have a good time. Yeah. This is just the foundation that needs to happen for everyone to be mentally well, parents, teachers, and students, so that the learning is the most effective and can take place. Because at the end of the day, learning, the act of learning, is a very vulnerable experience. You are shown something you've never seen before, and you are asked to practice it and to fail and to mess it up and to try again. Like, you have to really trust your teacher. You have to really trust that you're still an okay person, even though you messed it up. Like, think of the learning process. And we have to establish a safe mental wellness of an environment for the container for these kids and these teachers to learn as we go together, and for any of this to move forward.
Yeah. For those of you out here listening to the audio of this podcast, you can't see Emily King. We know her. She's a neighbor. She's a friend. We love and respect her. I'm picking up that you are very passionate about this, that you're feeling a sense of almost desperation, and yet you are trying to lead this fight. So we're very grateful for everything that you've said, but I can tell that this is also an emotional issue for you. So thank you for sharing that with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you for asking.
So tell us how people can find you, connect with you, learn about this course, all that good stuff.
Yeah. So you can find me at learnwithdremily.com. There's resources for parents there. If your child's been kind of newly diagnosed with autism, ADHD, anxiety, any of the neurodivergent ways to learn and shifting your parenting journey there. And then learnwithdremily.com/roster is where you can go to get my regulation roster, which is free for teachers. So you can start thinking about your kids from a nervous system perspective, what they're bringing into the classroom, how they regulate in the classroom first. And then once you're on my email list, you'll get info about the course this fall.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Emily King. Anything else we missed? Welcome. Anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think
so. You want to sing? This may not, she said kumbaya. We don't have to sing.
Well, thank you. That was awesome. How are you feeling?
I mean, I want to learn more about it. I want to learn more about how to change the paradigm of schools. I know we kind of touched onto it at the end. I know that right now the most important thing is showing appreciation for and collaboration with the teachers, right? Mm-hmm. She made that clear. But it was so clear to me as a neurodivergent child which stuff worked and which stuff didn't. And it's clear to me when I'm 47, but it wasn't clear to me back then.
Of course. You were too in the weeds. I mean, you can't see the forest from the trees, right?
Yeah. And so I'm kind of feeling almost as passionate about it as clearly she was, right? She's worried about this. She's obviously hearing a lot about it. She wants to advocate for this relationship between the student, the teacher, and the parent. But I'm trying to imagine what my life would have been like if I went to the Emily King School of Kids Who Don't Read Good. And if maybe that had, what if that does help smooth out some of these learning differences that people have? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, your brain's going to be the same either way.
You felt like your ADHD was just like flaming because of the system you were put into. So if you were,
yeah,
like if you were put into a different system, listen, we were not meant to sit behind a computer for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I think honestly, that's another blessing of COVID is that people who work from home now get to get out for walks during the day. Like they have reported being more active and not as confined. So I think in a way that's a nice sort of bonus that's happened. But yeah, if you learned in the sort of classroom that encouraged like movement, play, yeah, I think that would have been huge for you. And honestly, our kids.
Yeah. I mean, this could be going full circle. We don't really know because our kids are still much younger than I was when I got diagnosed. Of course, back then it was just sort of a new thing.
Yeah.
We're going to keep her on our speed dial as we move along with this. Thank you guys for being part of this podcast and for making it to the end. We are so grateful that you decided to spend some of your day just kind of chilling with us. And we're grateful for all of our friends, not just the ones who we call up to talk to, but also the ones who listen to our podcast.
Okay. Love you. Bye.
Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.